This is Whiskey Wanderlust.
And we're on an expedition to discover how Colorado is elevating craft spirits from grain to glass.
We bring whiskey explorers like you an inside look at the distilled stories, colorful characters, and rich flavors that make Colorado a true whiskey frontier.
So, pour yourself a dram.
And join us on an unforgettable journey.
On this episode, Root Shoot Malting.
Welcome to Whiskey Wanderlust, episode number 6, where today we are introducing to you guys Root Shoot Malting out of Loveland, Colorado. We got to sit down with Emily and Todd Olander over there, and we got to hear their story in a little bit of a different light from what we typically do, because we're typically interviewing distillers, which they actually meet that bill, but Ryan,
yeah, technically.
Yeah. So what, well, first of all, before we get into that, right?
Yeah.
Like it's been a busy couple months for us, right?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, for me personally, I know for you too, it's been pretty busy, just like other things we have going on, but it's also been busy in like good ways with a lot of different whiskey centric things that we've been doing. So
we were together this last week for Whiskey Church.
Yeah. Right.
And we had the opportunity to taste a new distiller we hadn't tasted before. And what stood out to you about that?
So, yeah, we did a Whiskey Church with Matt Hondorf with a downslope distilling. Yeah. I screwed that up.
Out of Centennial, right?
Yeah, out of Centennial. Yeah. And so it was really cool that the way that their head distiller is using like a prohibition style, or is it a pre-prohibition style distill?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
It's got these like two columns, and it's just, it was really different. If I'm sure that if you look on their social media, they've got photos of it.
Well, but they call it a double diamond. It's
double
a pot
diamond.
Still.
Yeah.
Double diamond, because it has some diamond structures in the head of the still, right?
Yeah. And it's just so different from the other pot still distillers that we've seen, mm-hmm. because generally the way he was describing it is that, you know, you like when you're going for the distillate, you want those heavier particulates, and they're going for the lighter particulates, mm-hmm. for their whiskeys and stuff. And so it made for very good whiskey. Mm-hmm. It was the first time I had tried it. So I really want to get up there and try some more of their selections and stuff, but it was really good.
Yeah. And, one of the interesting things about what they've done, right. They've created a distilling class, mm-hmm. right. Where, and there's a number of really like top pedigree distillers, right?
A few of the people we've talked to.
Yeah, in Colorado and elsewhere.
Yeah.
Right? That have taken Mitch's class, which is kind of fascinating. They're a small producer, and that's kind of their niche. There's just two of them, right? Mm-hmm. And they're doing all the operations there. And it was really interesting to hear their approach and how unique their new, and by the way, they have downslope, which is obviously a play to our local terroir here in Colorado, and stuff.
The mountain skiing.
They have two diamond shapes on their still. And so on their label, they have two diamonds on their logo and, you know, double diamond. And it plays to both the distillery and the ski culture here, which is kind of cool. Anyways.
Yeah. Genius marketing.
Yeah. Being a brand nerd, I was like, that's actually pretty clever. I just assumed it had to do with the ski culture, but
yeah,
it has to do with their still as well. So that was fun. You know, we also got to do this last month. We've had a busy month for our whiskey club, which mm-hmm. Ryan and I have had the privilege of joining a friend and his whiskey club here, where we, and Eric from 291.
Yeah. He's a member of that.
He's a member there.
Yeah.
But Wes Jolly, who, former writer for Modern Thirst, mm-hmm. Some years ago, he kind of heads it up, and we went through some non-American blinds this last month, and went through, and I think we helped the club break the 650-ish mark for whiskeys tasted over the years that they've been doing. That was a ton of fun. If you guys think we're just all about Colorado whiskey, we are, but we also enjoy, we diversify our spirits as well. We do enjoy.
Yeah. That club is very, the Scotch, very into the Scotch mm-hmm. world. Yeah. So, which like I've never had the opportunity to like try a bunch of different Scotches. And so I've really appreciated that experience. So.
Yeah. And for anybody who's interested in kind of being able to taste whiskeys that you maybe not be able to, I would strongly recommend you find a club of some sort to get into where, you know, the club kind of goes into financing some of the procurement of the different whiskeys in a way that you may not be able to do personally, and help, you know, get in with some other folks that have different flavor profiles and tastes than you, and be able to have maybe a little bit of a different experience. And then, you know, you can jump in and really taste some stuff that is maybe not your usual selection, and broaden your horizons and your taste stuff, which I think has been a ton of fun to.
Yeah. And it's really helped me develop my palate, because I'd mentioned when we started this podcast, I was sort of a whiskey noob. And so getting into the club and listening to other people, like doing tastings with other people at either a club or events like Whiskey Church, really helps to develop your palate. And you start to understand those, okay, what am I tasting in the glass? I know I like it.
Yeah.
But what are these flavors? You know, what is it that I'm tasting on the back end? And when you're hearing it from other people in the community, it helps to really, really develop your palate. So,
well, we've done enough of these interviews now, and we've gone through tastings. We've heard multiple, you know, distillers tell us, we don't like to influence your tasting. And there's a lot of reasons for that, right? Tasting is a very subjective practice. So if you think for a moment that a sommelier has has the tasting down to a science, and it's these things, and that's all that you're ever going to taste in there, that's not true. There's a lot of influences that are going to go into how you taste a whiskey, and it could be something you ate earlier that day, maybe the particular bottle you received, and there's lots of things that can go into that, the effect and of the nose and the palate and stuff the effect of the nose and everything else going into your palate and how you taste it. And so it is fun though to get in and to talk to people. Like, what are you smelling? What are you tasting? And, it is fun when kind of most people agree on some things, but then somebody else says, like, I was kind of a deviant this last on one of them. I was like, I taste mac and cheese.
Yeah. Hey, we've got notes like pencil eraser shavings and sweaty socks. And well,
I'm blanking on there's one that they were counting down. it was asparagus, but asparagus pea, right?
Yeah.
I suppose there are spirits that, could impart that on you. But
and whether you like that or not, like if you enjoy it, hey, more power to you. There's what we've learned is that there's no wrong answers in what you're tasting in the glass. And so there's no like, if you're just getting into it, whatever you have experience with is what, is what you bring 100%. To the table. And so.
And before you guys think our group is a bunch of psychos with asparagus pea notes, you do get a lot of the usual culprits, cinnamon and spice and oak and, all those flavors, heavy and tannins or citrus and stuff, depending on what you're looking at. But, and obviously since it's scotch, like we're tasting a lot of scotches lately, it's been a lot of peat and smoke, a fair amount of Islay scotches stuff in there. And a lot of them have been really good. I've not personally tasted anything that's been like, oh, this is terrible.
Yeah.
There's been ones that hadn't hit me just right. But
yeah. Been a ton of fun. Yeah. And then when I had started out, before we had gotten in the club and doing this podcast and stuff, anytime I tried a peated whiskey, it was the only thing I could taste was the peat,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
And so now when I try it side by side with other peated stuff, I'm starting to develop my palate more. Mm-hmm. I can start to taste the things that are underneath that.
Right.
And so it takes practice, like, hey, grab a glass and right. drink it up, I guess, but.
Well, and bring it full circle,
yeah.
to our tasting last week with Downslope, right? They had a peated American single malt.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
It was fantastic. But it was one of the more unique peated single malts I've tasted, especially on the American side, right? Because, there's some good producers out there right now doing peated single malts. Peach Street over in Palisade here in Colorado, and then Boulder Spirits does a great peated single malt.
Right here.
Yeah. And, there's some really good ones out there. Each one is different.
Yeah.
And Downslope, though, is producing a very unique, very, very well-rounded, very good product. So, but it's good to compare that to where all that stuff originated back in, in the Isles, right?
Mm-hmm.
It comes back to how that stuff has imparted its way and made its way over to the United States. And anyways, good stuff.
So, well, cool. Yeah. So that's been our month. But yeah, I think the highlight is anytime I get to sit down with you with a glass in hand, and it's a fun time. So,
well, by the time this airs, you will have celebrated a birthday.
Oh yeah.
And you're what, 27 now?
No, much older than that. I'm turning 38. So
38.
Yeah, by the time
still young.
This comes out, and like we're hoping it'll be last week I turn 38. So.
Yeah, you don't quite have 38 gray hairs in your
beard. Getting close.
Getting close.
The kids are making sure of that. So.
Yeah. Well, you wear it well, and those are well earned. So.
Hey, thanks.
Yes. So happy birthday.
Cheers. Hey, thank you. Cheers. Thanks. Appreciate that.
So before I move on, we would like to encourage you guys to like and subscribe. Obviously, we're really enjoying bringing this content to you guys, and we're having a lot of fun making it, but it is an effort. And so anything you guys can do to help share and subscribe to stuff, it goes a long way. So be sure to like us on YouTube and like us on socials, and obviously comment and give us any feedback you guys want to impart to us. We'd be very grateful for that stuff. And that's we're looking forward to bringing you guys more really good content, more really outstanding interviews from particularly right here. And who knows, maybe eventually we'll expand outside of Colorado and start, you know, going abroad.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Cause this is the Colorado whiskey expedition, but who knows where it'll go after that.
Yeah. So you know, season 2, 3, wherever we're at that time. Right. So.
Yeah. And you'll make that happen by subscribing, and that it really helps us out.
So. Yeah. So back to Root Shoot, right? We had an opportunity to go up on site to visit Todd and Emily up there and check out their really cool facility they have, which this is the first malt house I've ever been into. And tell me what stood out to you.
So I'm gonna say it's gotta be the cats, right? So the whole episode, they have two cats that are like part of the pest control there, right? And so their names are Dylan Pickle. It's a mother and a daughter. Mm-hmm. And I think it was
we didn't know which one was which though.
Yeah, Emily and Todd didn't know which one or which too, so which was kind of interesting. Yeah. But I'm gonna say that Pickle was the one that was jumping up. It was the daughter, the younger of the cats. So I'm gonna name her Pickle. So Todd and Emily, if you wanna just start calling that one Pickle, the friendliest one.
Yeah.
But yeah, they were just jumping up on our interview, like during our interview. So if you're listening to this, like, and you want to see the cats, because who doesn't love cats, right? But especially on the internet. But if you want to see the cats, you can go just take a quick glance at the YouTube video and see them jumping up on your lap mostly. Like,
yeah,
they were.
I don't know why, but
Pickle was really loving you. So
I'm not exactly a cat guy. I mean, I like cats on a cat by cat basis.
Yeah, what I've found is that people that aren't cat people are the ones that the cats are attracted to the most, because you want nothing to do with them, and cats appreciate that. And so that's why I think Pickle is jumping up on your lap the whole time.
To say I don't want anything to do with a cat, I mean, that seems a little cold. I mean, I do, I will, you know, I'll approach a cat and scratch its ears. You know, I do like hearing a cat purr, but, you know, for our family, we've been mostly dogs, right? And so I do think it's funny, though, that it was picking me. I was like, all right.
Picking you and Todd was like, get back.
Well, and of the people at the interview, you're the cat person, right?
Yeah.
Because you guys have.
Yep, we got two cats.
Yeah. So, I mean, and go figure, she was singling me out. And I was probably like the most mediocre moderate of the bunch, right?
Yeah.
Or Emily and Todd, you know, didn't really, especially Todd.
Yeah.
Which so, you hear that at one point.
Yep. So, yeah, if you listen to that, it was really funny. But yeah, so like, yeah, the cats were definitely a highlight for me. What about for you?
You know, obviously, we'd mentioned them before, I think, in one of our interviews, but you and I had an opportunity to participate in a fundraiser for their farm back in September. And over the summer last year, they lost 600 acres out of their 2,000 farmable acres that they, between what they own and what they lease. They lost 600 acres in a big hailstorm. And that puts a pretty big dent into their operations there. And so we had interviewed... we participated in a fundraiser to help bring funds back to them. And one of the cool parts about our Angel Share this particular go was, they were actually interviewing them as the recipients of some of these efforts rather than being the donors, and the philanthropic arm of, you know, like we typically do. So that was cool.
Yeah.
Be able to talk to them and just be able to share and talk to them about their experience with that and how all the other farming community and the distilling industry here locally contributed to give it back to them to make sure that they could make it through this next year, right?
Yeah.
So that was cool.
Yeah, and then just piggybacking off of that too, just talking about how, like, what I've come to find is that in Colorado, a lot of distillers they're competitors, but they're also friends, and, you know, and so they want to lift each other up and support each other and stuff. It was pretty incredible to see, like, other distillers.
Well,
you know,
and the cool part about the fundraiser we did in September, right, it was at Whiskey Church, which we just mentioned.
Yeah.
And it was actually the 291 tasting where Michael Myers, who you guys can go look at and listen to on episode 2, it was it was his efforts, and he pulled out a couple extra bottles. Yeah, I was like, spur of the moment. He just, you know, we raised, I think, $3,000 that night just from a little auction between a small group of 30 or 40 of us in the room.
Yeah.
And, you know, that was super cool to participate and see that. And then going to interview them after that was kind of fun. Like, it was a totally different angle than what we've historically done. So that was super cool. So,
yeah. But then also, the other highlight for me, just speaking on that whiskey community, is that how Root Shoot is partnering with other distillers to bring their own grain to make their own spirits with their own label on it.
Right.
And so they, like, you'll see in the interview, they don't have a still anywhere located on their property or in their malt house or anything. And so this particular bottle they partnered with a vapor distillery who creates Boulder Spirits to distill their own grain, you know, so they walked them through and helped them out through the distillation process, housed the barrels for them there, and then helped them to put the juice into the bottle. And so it's really cool how they're partnering, and they've got some other projects with other distillers. Mm-hmm. So be on the lookout for that on your local store shelves or anywhere in Colorado. But yeah, it's just neat that they're partnering to bring their own grain to the glass.
So. Yeah. Well, and as an extension of that, right, we get into it with, and it's Todd's family farm. It's been around for around 100 years. So we're pretty close to that anniversary. Mm-hmm. And their move originally from growing commodity grains to more heritage, sustainable grain stuff that are more, I say heritage, it's not even the term he uses, but, you know, more
intentional,
the grains that they're using. A diversity of grains he's bringing to the table for both the brewing and distilling, and bringing those terroir flavors from, you know, from really well researched grains that grow really well here in the state, and then he's imparting those and they're selling those to craft spirit brands and craft brewing brands. In fact, Talnua, we just interviewed last month, you know, they source Root Shoot's grains, which is, you know, super cool. And some of the others we've already interviewed, Boulder is one of them as well. Yeah,
291.
I think even Laws is getting, they're Cody Farms.
Yeah, they're Cody Farms and Whiskey Sisters. Yeah.
But it's still really cool to see their extension and be able to get on the malt house floor.
Yeah.
Which for the tour part, which go check out the tour for this one because it's unique speed for what we've done, right? We've gotten a lot of distilleries. We've seen open fermentation, closed fermentation. We've seen column stills to pot stills, and here we are. We're looking at gigantic malting kilns, which is super fun. And anyways, it was really cool to get down and actually see the malting process. Like, how does that work? And
I didn't have any familiarity with it too, so it was cool for me to learn some of that stuff. So
for sure, and the only part of that process we didn't get to do for that particular interview, which we wanted to, was the harvest, right?
But yeah.
A little out of season for that, but we'll catch them again.
We didn't want them to hold back for us, you know. We're just a couple of guys.
You're like, well,
yeah, it's all right. Okay. I think the battery died on it.
Leave that in there.
Yeah.
So, anything else that you want to recap?
I think we're good, and so... we can just jump straight into the interview with Todd and Emily Olander and Root Shoot Malting.
All right. Welcome to today's episode. We're here in Loveland, Colorado at Root Shoot Malting and Spirits, hanging out with us and giving us a tour of their fantastic facility and their local farm here. So, guys, welcome.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Thanks for being here.
Thanks for coming on the show.
Yeah. Thank you for having us.
By the way, coming in here, for those who are listening to audio and can't see what we're doing here, we're up in kind of a farming area north of Denver here, and it's just beautiful. We got beautiful sights of the mountains, and they have a really beautiful family farm. And Todd, family farm's been in your family a long time. It's 100 years old. Is that correct?
Almost.
Almost.
Two more years.
Okay.
Oh, okay.
If we can make it that far, we'll be in good shape.
So tell us a little bit more about the background of the farm and like how you guys got here today.
Okay. So, I guess it goes back. I'm the fifth generation farmer in Colorado here. My family, I guess, immigrated from Sweden. So we're going to go way back, I guess, and kind of settled in the Boulder area. And then they've been kind of like migrating a little bit north ever since then. And so sitting on this farm here, this was my grandparents' farm growing up. And it's been in the family since 1926. Like you said, we're really close to hitting 100 years of the century mark. And we've been it's kind of evolved over time. A lot of, like, back in the day, it was more cattle kind of operation. When my dad was doing most of the farming and everything, we were doing a lot of custom harvesting. And
one of your employees here?
One of our employees here, yes. Yeah.
Local pest control.
Yeah. and then growing small grains in the 1980s, we did a lot of that, a lot of growing for Coors. So right now we're farming about 2,000 acres or 2,500. And that's, we're growing barley, wheat, rye, alfalfa, and corn. Most of that we're growing, besides the alfalfa, is going to the whiskey and brewing industry. Which was the goal of the malt house when we started in 2016. I guess that's a kind of a brief overview. I didn't get into detail on a lot of it. I'm sure we will, but like that's just kind of where we are at the moment.
And so, growing up on the farm, did you imagine yourself, you know, coming to run the farm yourself? Was that your aspiration growing up?
Definitely not. No.
Okay.
No. When I graduated high school, I decided I was probably never going to come back to the farm. And,
okay.
And when I went to college, I got a construction management degree. So that's definitely wasn't on my radar. But every summer, even through college, besides one summer, I spent on the farm. So I've only been away from the farm only one summer in my entire life.
Okay.
And that summer, it's really kind of resonated of like, kind of miss that. I miss kind of the harvest and just all the work that goes into the farming and growing something every single year. And just being away from that was really kind of a realization that like I really want to come back to the farm and see what we can do. None of my brothers don't currently work at the farm, so I'm just kind of the last of the Mohicans, if you want to say.
So how many are in your family then?
We've got two brothers, one half brother, I guess, that lives in Houston, and then another brother that lives here locally that is kind of in engineering. He was the last ag engineer to come out of CSU before the program ended. So he still has like definitely some ag interest, but currently he's not doing that. He's like a mechanical engineer.
Okay. So going and doing your internship stuff, construction management, and getting your degree there, kind of on the opposite side of the table from farming, right? You're looking more at development construction, which is obviously a necessary trade, but tell us how, can you describe kind of maybe how you're then missing the farm on this summer internship and how maybe that kind of, that push and pull, like how did it push you back to farming?
Well, I mean, a lot of it really had to do with not wanting to listen to a boss. You know, I didn't want to have somebody telling me what to do, I guess. I wanted to kind of have the freedom to do what I wanted to do, the freedom to just make my own decisions and not have somebody like looking over my shoulder, I guess, on the decisions that we were making. And so my dad's always been really open to innovation and doing things differently. The neighbors in this area always have called my dad the innovator. He's tried all kinds of different weird things. And I think that's part of the reason why I talked him into opening a malt house and building a malt house. So that construction degree really has come into play with building this, right? Like we didn't really have a whole lot of outside engineering. My brother helped with some of that, but a lot of that construction background really helped with the building of this.
Sure.
And just, I guess, kind of back on just construction and development and things like that. Part of the reason I decided to come back and fight the good fight, I guess, is really trying to mitigate the development as much as I can. And then it's like preserve the family farm and kind of hopefully have a legacy of farming right here in Northern Colorado. I mean, the reason Root Shoot is called Root Shoot is because we have roots in Colorado and we want to shoot them, I guess. I don't know. I really wanted the word root to be in our in the name of our company because we're just rooted in Colorado. And that's something that
agricultural in term, right?
When exactly. And it kind of describes the malting process as well,
right?
You know, like you're shooting roots during the whole malting process. So it was just like, it was a aha moment in bed one night. I was like, it's going to be Root Shoot. So it's like, cool, what do you guys think? Yeah.
So I have a question. I was curious about with your logo, you have these four symbols.
Can you talk about like what those represent in your logo?
These symbols basically represent both the farming process and the malting process. Green can mean, you know, choosing the seed and picking the variety of seed that you want to grow. And then also, you know, bringing that seed here into the malt house. Blue is representative of water.
Okay.
So whether that be irrigating in the farm field or steeping here in the malting process. Mm-hmm. Yellow is kind of that whole growth period. So growing in the field and also germination here in the malting process as well. And then red is kind of the final step. So that could be harvest in the field and, you know, removing that crop off of the field. And then also the last step of malting is kilning and kind of stopping that growth period and getting a finished malt.
Okay. So. Cool.
Yeah. And then the fifth element that we've added is the still. And that's kind of where that's the centerpiece of Root Shoot Spirits is like that fifth element, which is the still, so which is like in the middle of the bottle there. So.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I was thinking that maybe one of them might represent a cat, but
maybe the last one, yeah.
friendly neighborhood pest control.
Yeah. So you said the name of the cats are Dill and Pickle.
Dill and Pickle.
Yeah, we just don't know which ones are
which. Ones which. They just work here.
Yeah, they do. They just work here.
They're very friendly. Emily, back us up a little bit. How did you guys meet? You've been now married for 14 years. Yep. What was your life? What did you envision for your life before you guys met? And like, how did you guys meet? How did Todd rope you into becoming a farmer?
Yeah, good question. So I grew up down in Denver. So I'm also Colorado born and raised. Grew up down in South Denver in Littleton. Moved up to Fort Collins because actually by trade, I'm a dental hygienist. So I've been working in dentistry for the last 20 years.
I'm real self-conscious about my teeth.
So that's what I do still. So I work part-time as a dental hygienist still.
Okay.
Oh.
And then Root Shoot is kind of every other waking moment.
Yeah.
But
it's farm life, right?
Yeah. I mean, that's it. So Todd and I met, I talk about dentistry because I met through one of the dentists that I used to work for was kind of friends with one of Todd's friends. And so
I thought you were going to clean his teeth. Like, yeah. I like this guy. I was like,
how nice teeth look.
He sure got pearly teeth.
He was a good listener.
Yeah. So anyway, so we, you know, kind of connected. And it's funny because I met him during the summer. And, you know, growing up in Denver, you don't really hear a ton about farming. And, you know, you're kind of secluded from that way of life growing up in a city. So when I met him in the summer, I didn't realize that he really was very busy. And so, you know, I'd always call him up and say, hey, like, should we go to dinner? Do you want to go to a movie? You know, and he always said, no, I'm in a tractor. I'm farming. You know? And I kept thinking, like, this is one of those, like, oh, he's just blow drying his hair and he just doesn't want to hang out with me, right? Like one of those one of those excuses.
He clearly blow dries his hair.
So I just for the longest time thought that he just didn't want to hang out. But I, you know, now come to realize that like he really was that busy in the summer, and like that is kind of the way of life, right? That you just work 12 hours a day, 15 hours a day, whenever you get your work done. So so it's been a change from growing up down in Denver and you know, kind of being pretty flexible with my career. It's a little less flexible, I guess, with farming because
absolutely,
you have to fight so many different things that are out of your control.
So how did you guys balance the whole, like, I'm working 15 hours a day and then farming relationship to, I mean, like, it takes work, right?
Yeah, it does.
For sure.
I mean, just like farming.
It was basically like, try to get up to Fort Collins because, I mean, the farm's here and she's living in Fort Collins and like, by 8 or 9 at night, usually, or something. And they're like, hey, let's hang out for a couple hours.
He was just always tired.
Yeah.
But that's really how we, I mean, being in Fort Collins, that's kind of how we, you know, found this love for both beer. I mean, Fort Collins is kind of this beer mecca of Colorado, and then also having some distilleries that are up there, too. So, I mean, that's kind of how that kind of morphed into our love for alcoholic beverages, I guess.
affinity.
Yeah.
Just kind of seeing how they like New Belgium and Odell, you know, grew from like these little tiny tasting rooms to what they are now. We lived basically from early 2000 to like 2017.
Mm-hmm. And that's where we would hang out. You'd always say like,
let's go meet our brewery. Let's go check it out.
Drink some whiskey.
I mean, once you get past liquor store level alcohol buying, right? Like there's that level. Then you get like on the craft side, right? And you realize that the operation is actually quite fascinating, right? And the process and mm-hmm. all the effort, hard work that goes into it, right? So tell us, now you're living and working now on a 100 year old almost farm, right? You guys have been married for 14 years.
Yep.
You've now transitioned fully to farm life, and I think it suits you well, right?
Yeah. Thank you.
I mean,
we wear lots of flannel.
Hey.
This was not planned. It's just what we have in our closet.
You're wearing flannel now if it wasn't for these shirts.
I think you wore flannel every other episode.
Yeah.
This is the same shirt I wore. It just says Whiskey Wanderlust on it. So tell us some of the challenges that you guys have now operating a farm in a rapidly developing area, right? Because Denver is encroaching north, right? Mm-hmm. Fort Collins is encroaching south, right? Coming the other way. And you guys it's encroaching at you from the west, right? East don't really have to worry about much yet, but
Well,
there's Bucky's, I guess there is. We'll talk about that later. But so tell us some of the challenges that have been kind of wrapped in you guys have been dealing with farm and kind of your efforts to conserve that that way of life here.
I mean, we always say that we're a farm first, right? So the farm doesn't exist without acreage and agricultural space to do that. And the malt house doesn't exist without that farm, right? Mm. So that's kind of where the conservation comes into play, is to try to protect farmland for forever, where only agricultural products can be grown on that land, as opposed to houses. In big development, so
houses don't make for great whiskey.
No, they don't.
Yeah, I mean, part of the reason we started the malt house is to get more value out of every acre that we're farming. Right, we kind of saw the writing on the wall that if we continued to farm the way that we had, like doing like custom harvesting and just commodity grains, that you're not going to be able to really sustain your operation here long term. So that's why adding value to what we're growing is something that's super beneficial for us, and also a necessity, I think, if we want to continue to stay in this area. So I think Emily mentioned on this a little bit that we put this property that we're sitting on into a conservation easement. And that is basically an agreement with a land trust that this land can only be used for agricultural uses for perpetuity.
And there's no getting out of it, correct?
There's no getting out of it.
Okay.
You can still sell this property, but that easement goes with it, right? Yeah. So you're reducing the value by placing an easement on it.
So whoever buys it has to buy it with the intention of farming it.
Yep.
Forever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you can leave little pieces out. So we left the corner out. You can't build buildings on a piece of agricultural land, right? So the malt house is actually not in the easement. And then there's another small acreage, about 5 acres, that's left out of the easement as well. So if you ever wanted to build a house or something on that too. There's still options there, right? Somebody could, if you wanted to sell it later, you could still sell it to somebody who wants to build a trophy home or something on it. There's still that opportunity, right? You're not just wasting all the value in the land. So, there's ways to navigate that still don't lose all the value in the
but selling it as a farm, correct me if I'm wrong, selling it as a farm carries a lot less of a price tag than selling it to the development, correct?
For sure. Yeah.
So the developers that want to come and they want to pay you high dollar because it's lands at a premium, they want to turn it into houses, and they're gonna turn a huge profit on that, right?
Yep. Yep.
And exactly. You'll never see that.
For sure. Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
Now that's a pretty big gamble for you guys at your age, right?
That was a difficult decision, really. I mean, even for my parents, right? It was a hard decision to decide to kind of go ahead and move forward with that. That's why it took us almost 3.5 years, 4 years to actually get it in place and make sure that it was a good idea.
Mm-hmm.
There are other farms in the area that have done the same thing, and I think that's something that's important for their family legacy as well. There's a lot of subdevelopments that have the little sign out front that says oh, this is Patterson Farm or something, for an example. But like you're still just driving into a neighborhood. Like, wouldn't you rather like have a sign that says like this farm is conserved for perpetuity and it's going to be open space forever and with your name on it? I mean, I think that's more of a kind of a legacy than than a subdevelopment that exists everywhere else.
Absolutely.
So hopefully we can convince more farms and farming families in this area that that's what they should do with their land, because they've been farming these properties just as long as we have, probably even over 100 years. So it'd be sad if they're the last generation to farm that as well. So,
right.
Yeah. I mean, obviously they're not going to see that in the future either, right? Like once you're gone, you're gone. But like, I don't know.
You're kind of weighing what's more important to you, right? Your family legacy and upholding that.
Todd loves cats.
Yeah, upholding your family legacy, or you know, would you rather have 4,000 of your best friends and your neighbors right next to you in houses? You know,
Yeah.
You know, it's a decision that they have to weigh, and for us, it's important to keep in farmland.
Yeah. Well, growing up in California, I grew up in a major agricultural area, right? And there's still legacy family farms that, you know, make big names, you know, and, you know, household names you guys know because of the grocery, you know, the lettuce you buy. And it's a big deal there, too. Like, you know, and fortunately, you know, the towns have not grown a whole lot to encroach on that. But it's, I think it's a big deal for, especially, and talk to us a little bit about, you know, the conservation side of it and like how, I mean, the long-term version for the growing and like your operations and the transition you guys are making to malting, like talk to us more about that and that path forward, right? Because there's, I think, a bigger legacy to be potentially made there as well, not just in addition to the farming, but like the other impact you guys make in the community. So tell us more about that.
Yeah, so, I mean, something that we really didn't know when we started the malt house was like kind of the impact on community that you can have and the impact on just educating people about farming. Like people are been removed. They're like two or three generations removed from the farm now. Not a lot of people that have that background, like even
like me.
Emily. Right? And so like using beer and spirits and things like that to educate the consumer about like maybe struggles that are happening in the farming community or just like where you're actually your food is coming from and what goes into that. So a lot of people don't even know that there's grain in a spirit or and where that even came from, right? There's like, I want to get drunk now on some levels, right? But then there's the other side of like, I really want to dive into what's actually in this bottle and what why does it taste the way that it does? So I think there's just a really interesting story there that you can tell and connect people back to the land a little bit. We hold a field day every year. We come and invite all of our customers to come to the field, see a harvest.
Oh, that's cool.
And like actually be able to stand in a field that they know is going to be like in either their bottle of whiskey the next year or a beer, you know, like that's something that when the first time we did that and we brought, I think we ended up getting like maybe 75 or 100 people to come to the field. And it's just quite amazing that majority of those people have never stood in a field before, let alone a barley field. No, I mean, that's a really big connection. We've done that, what, for the last 7 years now? I think we've done the event 7 years in a row.
How many people are you attracting now?
About 300.
That's cool.
Yeah.
I think we've hosted maybe up to 400 at one point. But yeah, it is pretty interesting. I mean, a lot of the you know, craft makers, you know, they get a full bag of malt and they open it and like that's kind of where it stops. Like they know that it comes from a warehouse that they ordered, you know, from Denver.
Right.
And, you know, so to be able to trace that back to, you know, farmland and the farmer is kind of cool.
Yeah. And so hosting these field days, what's the influence or in the impact on the brewers and on the distillers that you've witnessed or that they've mentioned to you through those events?
Really, I mean, it's kind of been an appreciation party for all the people that we work with, kind of, you know, just a thank you for them supporting a local farmer. And it's definitely morphed into like a bigger, a bigger fun party, you know, where you have local food producers that'll bring in some of their food, and you know, local music bands.
Wow.
So it's kind of nice to pull the community all together, and yeah, it has definitely grown over the last several years that we've been doing it. But
and it's good to get like front of house people too, right? People that are actually like interacting with the public.
Yeah.
So that they understand that whole process too. They're like, oh yeah, we brewed this beer or made this whiskey with the some grain that just was grown like 20 miles up the road, 50 miles up the road.
So yeah.
I think that just helps kind of continue to tell that story.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Well, before we move on too far, right? And for those of you guys who can't see this on site, literally as you're driving off the freeway, you drive right by the brand new Buc-ee's, right? And they're one of their little, I guess, I don't know, plots or part of the farm that you guys are growing or you guys are harvesting is right there next door.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Has that had a big impact on you guys at all? Or has that been just kind of something that was like bad for a while, it made it hard to get off the freeway, but
you know. I think, well, so we grow about 2,000 acres worth of crops, like Todd mentioned, corn, barley, wheat. And so only about 10% of that, or less than 10%, is what we actually own. And then the other part of that is leased farmland. And that particular property is owned by a development company, and has been for the last 20 years, 15 to 20 years. Mm-hmm. So we knew that, you know, being close to I-25, that
sure.
chunk was going to be developed. But I know, I think when we knew that, when we first heard that Buc-ee's was going to be coming to town, we actually, I had no idea what a Buc-ee's was.
Okay.
I had no idea. I mean, Texas-based company, right?
Yeah.
So anyway, so we were like, great. Yeah.
It's like a tourist stop.
It is.
Yeah, I don't think we realized how big and massive.
And then when it went in, like, what did you guys think? Like, oh my gosh! Like, what did you know?
Yeah, what is this? Yeah, it is amazing. I mean, people are stacking up on the highway just to get off and go to Buc-ee's.
Right.
So we've been in there what once? I think.
Yeah. I mean, if there's a takeaway from it, right? So go into Buc-ee's, get your beaver nuggets,
sure.
right? Yeah. And then
which I'm gonna go try some right
yeah.
when we're done here.
Go get your beaver nuggets.
He's and then
and you know all the swag. Go get a blanket.
Too. Yeah,
and the onesie. And
yeah. You go.
And then you can go get your gas across the road at Loaf and Jug, which is right there. And then you can go pick up a bottle of whiskey at the Red Barn, that's right there too. So it's kind of a good little roundabout where you can support all these other local folks too.
Well, but, so you've talked about like your local. You know, local profile, right? And I mean, Buc-ee's is a pretty big tourist attraction, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Have you guys thought of ways you can maybe leverage their presence there and your farm bean right here? That you guys would be like, hey, localized farm bean type thing?
We have thought about that. We're not sure how to capitalize on it yet, though. We've thought about trying to get a hold of them and see if they would produce some sort of beer that they could sell. Because I know they sell beer in the, I mean, I don't think they can sell spirits,
right.
but they can sell beer. So we've been thinking about trying to contact them, which we have all their contact information about, like having a Buc-ee's beer,
sure,
which would be super cool. But I think that's kind of a hard pitch. So
I mean, if anybody from Buc-ee's is watching reach out to Todd Emily. Yeah, I mean, even if you had some sort of display with like local brands mm-hmm. that are using your malting, that would be
for sure.
Be a really cool partnership.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's right along the highway. So, I mean, I'm sure you could put a sign up there or something that just is all these people that are driving past it. So, we get lots of, like, when I was harvesting that field, it was corn this year, and there's lots of people that stopping and watching. They're like, oh, what's going on over there?
Exactly.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's pretty cool that I always enjoy that people are actually interested in, like, what's going on in a field next to a big old gas station. So,
Yeah, a big old gas station.
Yeah. Gas station.
You mentioned gas at Loaf and Jug. It's like, there's 120 pumps to fix
They always
have to wait in line for gas.
They always have the cheapest gas, too. That's,
oh, wow.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. They don't advertise it, but it's the cheapest.
Yep. Yeah. So, that's cool.
And very clean bathrooms.
Just piling it on. Just keep putting some goodwill towards
I know.
Them.
Yeah.
So but we went down to Dallas and visited one with my kids last year, and then when they put one in here, like my kids,
they're
so like on a road trip, we hit up and stopped by, and my kids were super excited. But
that's awesome.
I could see how it could be both a blessing and a curse, right? So all right, so like let's talk dive a little bit more about the facility we're in here, right? So you mentioned construction background, getting this up off the ground, and the purposes of getting this, but talk to us about that transition from
supplying barley to Coors and Budweiser. I think you mentioned the call, you know, like getting away from, and I think you even mentioned a little bit earlier, getting away from commodity buying, but mm-hmm. and how that process kind of got difficult because your grains were rejected for, you know, you didn't really know why and yep. how that's happened. So, and then like, what challenge did you guys have getting this place up and going, and how is it? I mean, it's now 8 years old, right? 2016 does.
Yeah. Right? It's coming up on 9 next year. Yeah.
How's it going?
I mean, it's going great.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're doing good. Definitely challenges along the way. Definitely had no idea what we were doing. When we decided to do this, like we just figured people will start knocking down our door, give me some of that malt, you know, and that hasn't been the case at all. But I mean, it's been work trying to sell it and to gain trust, I guess, from people. Like there's malt houses have been doing this for 100 years, like, right? As long as we've been farming this property, they've been malting. So it's hard for somebody to just decide that they're going to use your grain. They want to make sure that it's good quality because they're serving their beverages to the locals and just to their customers, right? And they want to know that that's a good product. They want to know that whatever they're making that product out of is really good. Mm-hmm. And so that took some time. I mean, it took quite a while, probably about 7-8 months really to kind of like start things to get going. We're learning how to malt as well. Like we're trying to figure that whole process out. We're experimenting mm-hmm. with different barley varieties. Like you just didn't know anything. The only reason that barley was grown in this region was because it was grown for Coors. And the only barley variety that was being grown was that Moravian, which is a proprietary Coors variety, right? So we went on the search. We went to Canada, North Dakota, and all over the place trying to find different barleys that we could grow here that hadn't been grown here before. So we started with like 7 different barley varieties. So throw that on top of learning how to malt. You're swapping different barley varieties and trying to figure it all out, that was quite a challenging road. And the brewers helped us. I mean, we sell more of our barley to breweries than actual distilleries, just because they move through that volume a lot faster. So they kind of pointed us in the right directions of like what was tasting good for them or what was kind of efficient in the brew house for them. So that's why we've moved towards this Genie variety, which is what we're growing mostly. We are starting to experiment with some different winter barleys just to help kind of on the I guess you could say changing climate or just environmental impacts of just trying to continually grow like a super high quality barley. And so we're just trying to look at what are some other options that we can use that will fit into our rotation.
Well, it's, I mean, for you guys, it's a very strategic decision you guys have to make, right? So you have to find, this is your land, you guys are growing it. There's mm-hmm. conservation farming techniques that you guys are, sustainable farming techniques that you guys are practicing, right? Mm-hmm. You can't exhaust the soil, right? You've got, and it takes time to grow and then harvest and go through the malting process. I mean, mm-hmm. You got to back that truck up so far. Mm-hmm. And so like have you guys just kind of felt like you guys have just kind of stumbled into what you guys have, or have you guys really found like, oh no, like that guidance from those distillers has been really good because there's a couple of varieties that grow really well and it blends really well with our techniques, something like that. Like, tell us more about that.
Yeah. I mean, the Genie barley has worked really well for us. I mean, it's not knowing a whole lot about different barley varieties when we got into this. There's just some different tendencies that they have that they've been bred into these different barley varieties, the breeders. So Genie is like a LCS or Lima grain variety, and it was bred in the UK and France and in that area where they get a lot more moisture. So those grains have dormancy, and that's like the biggest thing that's really helped us to can keep our quality high, is because that dormancy, if you get a rainstorm like right at harvest, you're not going to lose like that germination capacity. You're not going to lose the life in it really. Because of a rainstorm, because it's not ready to actually sprout until it sits in a grain bin for like 3 to 4 months. And those barley varieties that are grown for Coors or like most North American barley varieties really don't have that dormancy. And so like one big rainstorm can pretty much wipe out your crop, right? Mm-hmm. And so
do we
just kind of fell into that. Like, yeah, I mean, not recently, no. But right around harvest, they say there's a monsoon season in Colorado, and it sometimes it happens, and you can get some rainstorms. But
I would just anyways, I would just imagine just, the unpredictability of weather here would be a really big challenge for growing that crop, right? Because it's like every year, it just you never know.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, that Genie barley's helped us a lot for consistency of getting a good quality barley off the field. So and then also looking at those winter varieties, those are coming off like a month earlier than the spring barley, which is Genie. So that's another reason is it's like the less time that it has the chance to get either hailed on or rained on, like, and we can get it off the field a month earlier, like the better that is. Also those winter varieties are maturing when the temperatures are a little bit cooler, so there's less stress. So that helps kind of maintain the quality too. So protein level is really important in barley varieties and barley in general. And so that's what we're, the more the barley's stressed, the higher the protein is going to be.
Yeah. And so are these winter varietals, are they allowing you to like extend your growing season then?
Yeah, so we're planting those in spring, or not spring, in the fall. So like September, October. So they're already in the field. They're already growing. They're already about this tall, right? So that's a huge head start on something you're going to plant in the spring that's got to start from here in like February and March.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's why you get that month head start on harvesting.
Nice.
So yeah. You said you start harvesting those in February, March timeframe, and then you start.
No, so we'll plant spring barleys in February, March.
Okay.
Harvest isn't going to happen until like late July, early August.
Okay. In that region, so they just take longer to grow, and they're just pushed out into the next season before you're harvesting even the winter varieties then?
Okay. No, the winter varieties are coming off early. Sorry, I probably haven't explained it very well. So.
Start over time.
So when do you harvest the winter varieties then?
Like early July, really. So you're almost getting, and so let's say you're harvesting the winter varieties early July, and then you're not getting to the spring varieties till like early August. So there's like almost a month, three weeks. So we've only been growing those for about 3 years now, so we don't know exactly what's happening. and it all depends on kind of the winter too, how harsh the winter was, if it gets kind of frozen off and it has to restart, or if it's just ready to rock and roll if we have a fairly mild winter.
Okay. But so those barley varieties, you plant in October and they don't get harvested in July. There's a lot longer growth season for them, and then versus your spring varieties, which grow a lot faster and you're harvesting a lot sooner.
Yeah, for sure.
That's what I thought you understood. And I did explain it. I just want to make sure.
We're on the same page.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just growing much, much slower, right? Because there's cold temperatures. It's not like getting after it when the spring varieties, like the soil temperatures are increasing pretty quickly. During the winter, it's soil temperature is just going down. So it almost goes dormant.
Gotcha. So for those of you guys who are just listening in, and if you're watching and you haven't watched the tour yet, which we'll be doing separately, just off of the back side of this wall over here to my right is a bunch of storage silos, correct? Mm-hmm. I'd imagine that's what they call it, right? Storage?
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Grain bins.
I'm not a farmer. So, and then... just on the wall over, just straight in front of Ryan and I here is their malting part house. And right here, we're in their storage facility, which I guess maybe the tour is you can explain some of what's going on here with these smaller silos here. But so they come off the farm, right? You store them here and then you get into the malting process, right? So talk to us more about that malting, especially because people, they might know whiskey, they might know beer, but they don't understand what the malting process is and how that works, right? Obviously, if you're a scotch drinker, you might know a little more about it because that's a big part of that process there in single malts, right? But if you're not, so tell us more about that process and how does it end up from the farm, like end up on, you know, from the combine, right? Blended and then into the bottle.
Yeah. So we'll start in the field, I guess. So at harvest, you're using a combine. Most people are familiar with what a combine is from,
cars.
Yeah, exactly. that's what I was going to say. Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah, it's great. Yeah. So a combine, the purpose of it is to kind of like start the whole like separating process. So it's separating the grain like out of the kernels and like taking it off the field. So comes off the combine, goes into a truck, and then it gets delivered here and goes into one of our grain bins out there. So we can hold about 3 million pounds of grain in the back, which is about a year's worth of supply for us. From there, we run it through another cleaner to just size the kernels. So we're getting rid of all the small kernels that we don't want. Smaller kernels absorb moisture a little bit differently than larger ones. So you want your product to, or your finished grain to be like as uniform as possible, because it's all going to malt kind of very similarly that way. Also, we're removing like any sort of weed seeds that were came in with the combine, and then any sort of
rock
other
sticks.
Like rock sticks. Yeah, not very many rocks, but yeah. Anyway, yeah, just making sure that it's nice and clean before it goes into malting. So from there, it just goes into the steep tank, and the steep tank is where hydration starts. So we're bringing that moisture content of the grain from about 10 or 11% that we when we harvested up to 40%, 42%. So it spends about 36 hours in the steep tank, either underwater or not. It goes under two immersions is what we do here. So it goes underwater for about 8 hours the first time, then about 12 hours not underwater, and then another 6 hours underwater again. And while it's underwater, we're blowing air into it. And that's just kind of mixing and homogenizing everything. We're just like really trying to treat all the kernels equal so that they absorb moisture, they grow all at very similar pace. From the steeping, it transfers into these drums, the germination drums, and it spends about 5 more days in there. And during that time, we're controlling the temperature. So we don't want that temperature to really be above 60 degrees. Some malt houses, like if you're really trying to crank through malt and you have some, and different barley varieties will kind of change how your malting process goes too. But we're slow and steady is kind of our mantra. Like it, usually you have better quality malt if you have low temperatures and longer time. So we're trying to keep it around 60 degrees throughout that whole process. We actually lower it once it gets further into germination, and that will kind of help enzymes like alpha amylase and beta amylase kind of increase. So depending on what temperatures you use during germination, you can change kind of the enzyme package on the final malt. So then after the 5 days, then we go into kilning. And the kilning is where most of your flavor is coming from. Most of your color in beer is going to come from that too. So like the higher the temperatures, the more roasty kind of Maillard reactions that you get, the darker the malt's going to get, and kind of it gives you kind of a little bit more unique flavor than like your base malts, which don't have a whole lot of character to them. They're just really used for alcohol. I mean, that's really just where all the alcohol is coming from, is a base malt.
Right. So, and for like, I mean, a lot of good nugget stuff in there in terms of what, like what's actually happening, which is really good for understanding, but for like the intent, right? That you're, the malting process helps maximize the sugar in the grain, correct, for the fermentation process? Is that-
yeah, so we're breaking down the starch inside that kernel and creating these enzymes I was talking about. So those enzymes, once the starch is kind of degraded and available, those enzymes, once they get hit by hot water in the mashing process, those enzymes go to work and they start chopping the simple sugar or the starch into simple sugars. And then once you make your sugar water, your wort, then that's where the yeast comes into play, where that's going to start breaking those simple sugars down into alcohol.
And so how long is that process from going from silo, steeping, malting process, and then into a bag? About how long is that process?
Like seven days, typically. So we've got three drums. We empty one on Monday, we empty and then refill it. And then we empty one on Wednesday, empty and refill it. And then one on Friday, empty and refill it. So, and then that process just continually goes.
Keeps going. Okay. And then how long would you say that one of the, like the finished bag, how long is that like shelf stable?
Up to a year. Some of the like roastier malts that like can degrade a little bit more quickly if they...
It just might lose its character a little bit.
Okay. A little bit, yeah. But typically everything in our malting facility is no more than 6 months old.
Okay.
Yeah, the more like oxygen that it's available, the more that kind of flavor will degrade.
Okay.
So we go into bags. So I guess after kilning, it gets cooled. So, and we just use outside air to cool down the grain. So it's usually emptying out of those drums about 70 degrees, 60 degrees. And then it goes into these bins behind us, and then it gets cleaned again. So we clean off all the rootlets and any sort of other like material. So like it's, and malt is a very clean product, right? It gets cleaned before it goes into the malting process. It gets washed twice, and then it gets cleaned again before it goes into a bag. So like it's pretty darn clean product at that point. Yeah. But anyways, then it'll go into a bag and probably, I don't know, maybe 4 days after it came out of the kiln. So like freshness is pretty good there, I guess. Like much more fresh than something that's going to come from Europe or even a larger malt house in the country. Like usually our malt's hitting people's mashing tons, like, I don't know, 3 weeks after it's been made.
Oh, wow. That's really fresh then.
Very fresh. Yeah. Yeah. It makes a huge difference in your finished product.
Yeah.
And so how many, I was going to say customers, but how many brands are utilizing your malt, what would you say, for like both beer and whiskey producers?
I think we're at right around 125, 130
and they're all here in Colorado?
Distilleries in Colorado.
Okay.
There's a handful that are outside of Colorado that we just use a third-party delivery to ship to Texas, Alabama.
Chicago.
What? So a handful that are you know outside of Colorado.
Goose Island in Chicago? Or?
No.
Are there any brands you want to mention that you know some of our listeners or viewers would recognize that are utilizing your grain?
Yeah, 291 in Colorado Springs. They used some of our malted rye before, and then majority of their product was made with our corn. Boulder Spirits, they've used our grain a few times. And then Family Jones, who else? Mm-hmm. The Block.
Mm-hmm.
It's always hard.
This is always, I know, when we're always put to the test. Yeah. Like, we work with so many of them, it's like,
yeah.
To recite it back is hard.
The Heart.
Yeah, there's a lot of smaller distilleries too. There's Denver Distillery. And Balmer Peak. Yep. Some of those little guys that are down in Denver. she wants to join the party.
She hasn't come to me.
So it's fun working with some of the smaller producers, I feel like, because they're also a little bit more experimental, I feel like, which is kind of your mindset too, being we're kind of a smaller farm too.
Right.
Whether it seems like that or not, like we have the ability to kind of play around with some of those, you know, different grains. And so I feel like when you work with a producer who also has that same mindset, it's kind of fun to, you know, talk with them about different varieties.
With 291 on your list, I mean, you can officially say your grains have been featured on Netflix, right?
Right. So. It's true.
Yeah.
That's cool. That's pretty cool. Yeah.
So let's talk a little about, local sourcing, obviously, and I do want to talk about like your project behind your actual distilling, right?
Sure.
But since you're talked about local brand stuff too, let's talk about terroir for a minute, right? Which is a term obviously from the wine industry, right? But it's a growing term in the whiskey, especially looking at localizing and really building out brands within their local regions, right? And I know Talnua is big on that term, and some other stuff.
Mm-hmm. We forgot them.
Yeah, they're on your list, right?
Yeah, they are.
They're pretty top on our list.
Yeah. I mean, and what they're producing is fantastic, right? And so I've been out to California and talked to Hinterhouse out there in Arnold, and they're talking about the same language, right? They're doing single malts as well out there. So that's a growing term in the industry and stuff. And so tell us your role and kind of how you're casting vision with both, not only what you're doing on the farming and the malting level, but then moving into distilling, right, and helping out with those local brands, and how do you feel like Root Shoot is helping kind of galvanize that term in the industry?
Yeah, that's a big subject, I guess, and it's hard to really know like where these flavors are coming from, right? Obviously, our soil is different than soil in California or Oregon or something along those lines, but I don't know. My opinion is that like the healthier the soil, kind of the more like they call this like nutrient dense or whatever, which is hard to kind of translate into a spirit or something. But I think that kind of translates into like a better product in the end. We've won a ton of awards. We have this malt cup thing every year, which is a bunch of small maltsters that work well. There's about 65 craft malt houses throughout the world pretty much at this point. And there's a competition every year. It's kind of like
GABF. 65 of the world?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah.
And you say craft, so these are like
smaller scale. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
And we're probably on the larger scale when it comes to craft malt houses. Okay. But anyways, there's a malt cup that we have every year where people can submit their malts and have them judged or whatnot. And we've won an award every single year. And I know that a lot of that has to do with, starts with the farm, right? Like we, since we have control of that, like a lot of that's going to come from the actual soil and the growing environment. So I think that has a lot to do with the terroir. And then the malting process and the malt houses, they have their own like house flavor too, right? I mean, you can pull all kinds of different levers through the malting process. So that's really hard to dial in, like, what is it that we're doing that's like making all these super high quality grains? But I think it starts with the farm and the soil, malt house and the technology that we have and the ability to kind of pull these different levers to get different flavors out is super important too. And then just the different varieties that we've been messing around with as well as another lever that you can pull. So there's just so many variables, it's hard to like really pinpoint what it is. Mm-hmm. All we know is that we're making really good products and we wanted to like share those with other producers so that they can continue to make really good products.
I mean, I think from like an industry standpoint, like, right, I mean, California is known for the wine, right? So all the grapes and all that stuff is going on there, right? France, same thing, right? And so you've got this kind of regional recognition for the quality of the products that are grown and then produced in those regions. I think, I think, you know, Colorado's no stranger to growing grains, right? Just for different reasons over the years, right? But I think now with the craft distilling industry, I think there's a big opportunity for, you know, for that to, you know, for Colorado to kind of carve out a particular, you know, quality standard, right? That is across all of the, you know, all the distilleries. And,
yeah,
and just get more of them on board with, you know, influencing that. I think it's a, I think it's a win-win for everybody, right?
Yeah,
local farming, right?
Yeah, I could touch a little bit more on that if you want.
So, yeah, I'd love to, and then segue into how, you know, like this project, right? Because I think you mentioned on the call earlier that, you know, this was a little bit of a project to help shed light in the local markets about the importance of localized farming, right? Which that plays into our terroir, you know, conversation, right? So
yeah, so. I mean, just to touch on terroir a little bit, my dad used to work with like a seed breeding company that was local for wheat seed. And those wheat breeders had access to all types of different like environments that they could grow them in. And this region right here, like basically west of I-25 is just really a great growing environment because the mountains are so close. We're right here in the foothills. You got nice, cool evenings like the... I don't know, soil pH is just about right. So like that just, I don't know, if you have like a seed breeder that's been on like thousands and thousands of acres and says that like this is a great place to grow small grains, then like I think that means something. I think that, and I think that's another reason why we've had such good success with the products that we're producing. So you want to segue into the whiskey a little bit?
I didn't see... a still anywhere when you're walking around here. And so
lots of other equipment though,
right? So how are you guys then, you know, turning your own malt into whiskey?
I think that's a big part of why we have Boulder Spirits also up here, right?
Okay.
So we work with Vapor Distillery out of Boulder, who produces Boulder Spirits. To produce our whiskey for us. So
how did the partnership come about with working with Boulder Spirits to distill your grain?
Yeah, it was about 5 years ago, six years ago.
When we first started. I mean, really, we were trying to sell them malt is where we made that connection where it's like, hey, you should be buying our malt instead of buying it from Scotland or UK or whatnot. And, and he's been a tough nut to crack, I guess. but they are kind of like starting to lean into kind of some of our malts nowadays. But anyway, they weren't using their still. And we had some different malts that we wanted to kind of experiment with and see if there was some good flavors that could come out of that. We're like, hey, we should probably just throw these malts into a barrel and see what we get and see, like, really start experimenting with like what malt character kind of. It's hard to know, I guess, like once you put something into a barrel, like what it's going to be after it sits for 5 years, right? There's so many variables, right? Like probably a million different variables that can go into the whole product. But yeah, I guess that's where that kind of came from, was just like, let's see if we can make some spirits and see like if we can make something unique and different, and then really try to get to be a little bit more consumer facing. Like, a lot of our business is just B2B. Like, we're just working with breweries or distilleries, but we don't have like a front facing product that we can really connect the farm to the consumer. And so that's where this whiskey brand kind of came from, was just bringing awareness to farming. We've been, in the early days, like 6 years ago, we were just like, let's just throw these malts in here and see what happens. And then now that we've kind of tasted through them, we've been a lot more strategic on like what we're actually going to put into the recipe.
Right.
So vapor really doesn't have any say in like what we're actually going to use. We've definitely taken their advice because they're a lot more, they're a lot more knowledgeable than we are in the space. But as far as like the recipe of grain that we're sending them, those are our decisions. Those are like what we think is going to make a really good finished product after 4 or 5 years.
Yeah. And so how many barrels did you end up filling in that first run?
Just 10.
10, 10 okay.
barrels. Yep. Yeah. So that was our first release. We have...
What, those were like, full-size 50-gallon, right?
Yeah, 53-gallon.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And every year we've sent malt to them. About the same capacity. I think we've increased the amount of grain that we've sent them over the years. So, okay.
So do you still have barrels aging right now?
For sure. Yeah.
Okay.
I think we have. Should we say it?
We should. We have about 200 barrels.
Wow.
Of whiskey.
Is it that much? 200.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Okay, so where are you going to put the distillery?
Maybe on that 5 acre. Right,
that's not for a house. That's for a distillery. That's a tasting room.
And we might have gotten a little bit carried away with making whiskey, right? We got excited about the whole process of it, and just like, I don't know, it's very fun to make whiskey. So, and we have lots of different barrels with different malts in them now, right? We just, now we can really see what the grain is introducing to the barrel and to the finished product. And so I think that's probably why we ended up with so many. Like, all these barrels have like different malt bills in them, so like we're just like, hey, what'll that do, and then eventually we can kind of blend those together.
And all of them are single malt.
Those are single malt. So so we have more than that on top with some projects that we've done with 291, making like a 4-grain bourbon. Molly Brown is making like a heritage grain bourbon with us. So it's all heritage grain. It's all Oland wheat.
Yeah.
It's all Abenaki corn. The malt isn't heritage, I guess, but that's a very small percentage of that bourbon.
And all of that will be released under your label.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Very cool. And then Family Jones, we did a wheated whiskey. So we've got different projects coming down the line.
I think that's kind of the fun part, right, is that you also get to work with the customers who have supported us and who have bought malts or corn or whatever it is that they have purchased from us, that we can also kind of work with them too, and they can make a product for us.
Yeah.
So working with 291 and Vapor and...
and Vapor. Finally, we're not getting a cat. Right? So I was thinking,
it's being been fun.
A marketing... nerd on my, for my career, right? I think for you guys, you have an advantage to be able to sell your grains to these distilleries, because you guys can say, hey, look at the end product. Look, this is what we're getting.
Mm-hmm.
And they could come in, they could taste these, and they go, wow, this is, this is what we're after. And you guys have a little bit of advantage, because you guys play around maybe a little bit more than they may be able to, right? Because they got they've got bigger investments, but you guys have other income sources that they don't have, right? So you have the ability to kind of bend and flex and be a little more flexible and produce that stuff. And then be able to show them, hey, this is what it looks like in the bottle. And then, they go, yeah, I want some of that. So that's that's a pretty cool. And now, you guys don't have a distillery yet.
I probably won't, honestly. I think it's more fun kind of working with other distilleries and kind of really making that partnership a true partnership, and then... distillers have a different take on what their process is. 291's way different than Family Jones or even Vapor, right? Or Talnua. Mm-hmm. Like, everybody thinks that there's a different way to make something. So if you can kind of play off of what their strengths are and make our own product by like giving them the different grains to produce it with. Like, I think that makes sense to us. Like, why own a still and try to teach ourselves how to become distillers and have that huge investment in it when we can just work with all these other guys to produce different spirits.
I think we talked on the call, like, becoming an estate distillery, right?
Which right.
I, and as a marketing guy, I'm like, dude, that's a cool tag to have, right?
That would be really cool. I know. We've definitely thought about it.
Yeah.
And who knows what the future holds, but like as of now, I think just working with other producers is what we'd rather do.
Okay. Sure. Mm-hmm. And so this is batch 2, correct?
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
And so when can listeners start expecting some of these other ones that you had mentioned to start rolling out?
Yeah, batch 2. So we just bottled last week.
Okay.
So mm-hmm. that will hit shelves.
Fresh.
Yeah, it'll hit shelves here next week. Next.
Okay.
A little variation of the malt bill went into batch 2. I can't remember the exact proportion of it, but there's some Cara Ruby, there's some specialty grain, there's some.
Yeah, special roast is what we call it. So yeah. Like super, very small percentages, a little genie pale, a little distiller's malt. Like it's definitely a mixed bag of different things.
So it has a little different, a tiny bit of different flavor than the first batch.
Mm-hmm. We're trying to stay like true to our brand, I guess, as far as the whiskey style goes.
Right.
Like we're using more specialty malts than like a lot of single malt distilleries might. But like I said, like each year is going to vary just a little bit on like what the actual like finished product is and what the blend of the barrels are. So,
right.
Yeah. We do have another beer barrel finished whiskey that's also going to release at the same time as this second batch. So it was kind of in a collaboration with Upslope. So we took the barrels last year. I took two of those barrels and they brewed a Imperial Brown Ale. And then they emptied those barrels after they used them for the beer. And then we filled those back up with the whiskey from this year. So, and then they spent like about almost a year actually in those Imperial Brown barrels. So it's kind of a unique flavor and unique style too. It's just got this little more pine flavor to it, I guess. A little like almost hop character that's coming through. Yeah, it's very interesting. So yeah, look for that on the shelves as well.
Let's shift gears a little bit. Yep. And I mean, obviously you guys have had, I think some, I'm excited to try this, by the way. And I think you guys have a very unique story in the place, but you guys also have a little bit of a unique angle for us because we set out to start this podcast to talk to farmers and stuff too, but one of the segments we have is called the Angel Share, right? It's where we focus on the ways that our distilleries are giving back. But you guys, not only being a farmer, you guys were a little bit of a different angle of that, right? Last year you had a bad hailstorm that destroyed a pretty good crop of yours, right? And it was your barley, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or no, it was corn.
It's corn, barley, and alfalfa.
So it's all three, okay. Yeah. And so obviously the Angel Share, you know, we want to focus on ways people give back, but you guys were actually the recipients, right, of a community effort to help restore you guys back to a state where you guys could have a little bit more in your hopper, so to speak, right, for next year, which is kind of a big thing. So
yeah,
tell us a bit more about that. Like, obviously, the effects that it had on you guys. And like, I mean, the community coming together, tell us more about that experience.
Yeah. So just to touch on the hailstorm, it was pretty devastating. It took out about 600 acres of ours. Mm. We actually got to like sit in the pickup and watch it. So,
were you stuck out there while it was happening?
Yeah. We were out checking water, like just checking on a pivot. And we were just like, man, that looks like a pretty nasty cloud. And so like, let's get out of this field. And so we just started driving and the dog was actually like out of the pickup and we were just kind of like driving on the outside out of the field. And by the time we were out of the field, there were just hailstones coming down there. I don't know, at least marble size, ping pong size. Yeah. And so dog was in a real hurry to get back in the pickup. So
yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And so we were able to just drive and like sit behind a tree. So we didn't really take much damage to the vehicle, but we just knew that it wasn't going to be good for the crops, right? We just drove out of a cornfield that was being irrigated.
Yeah. I don't know if it was better to be there watching it or if we were just at home like sipping on whiskey. It might have been a little
less dramatic.
Yeah. Well, and so you said 600 acres, yeah. And you mentioned earlier a little over 2,000. So it's like a quarter of your serviceable farm. That's crazy.
Right. Yeah. 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 So a lot of that is alfalfa. So alfalfa like recovers pretty quickly, right?
Sure.
You get four cuttings or five cuttings sometimes a year off of that. So
We basically lost a cutting off of it.
So, but I mean, still, that's not nothing. And then there was 120 acres of corn that was destined for distilleries that was destroyed.
We actually grew a little bit of blue corn.
Oh yeah, we had some blue corn too.
We had some Hopi blue corn that we sourced from Texas, and yeah, that was kind of an experimental plot that took so much time and effort to try to get that thing to finally grow, and it was just going to be a really cool project to have this blue corn
and it's gone.
And so that was just gone too.
Like 5 minutes.
Yeah. Pretty much, yeah.
Yeah, it was crazy. Yeah. It was crazy.
So with the big hailstones and then the like 70-mile-an-hour wind, it just broke everything over. And then there was like a 70-acre barley field, which usually like if you get a hailstorm that rolls through, like there's going to be some kernels that are still kind of hanging on to the stalk, but it was nothing. Absolutely nothing.
Wow.
So it was impressive.
The yield that you lost, that if you would have harvested and sold it, what did that amount to?
So the barley would have been, I don't know, about 750,000 pounds or so.
Okay.
So, that's a pretty good loss. And then the corn, even more, probably like close to 1 million pounds, or maybe even more than that. So
in terms of dollars, like what did that cost?
It depends on how you look at it. But yeah.
Opportunity. Yeah. It's like opportunity cost, right? Because I mean, that's the best way to value it.
Yeah.
Right?
I don't know. $500,000 or more. Yeah.
Yep.
$500,000, 700,000 for your. Yeah.
That's huge.
So, yeah.
But how did the community respond, right? And like, I mean, we were privileged to be a part of some of the community outreach, but like, we didn't say everything, right? And we know there was a t-shirt initiative, right, that went out, which we got t-shirts.
Yeah.
And, you know, but tell us more about like how that came together and like, I mean, probably traditional farming, you don't like to even ask for money, right? So it's not something you guys are, proud to do.
Totally.
So.
Yeah, we were a little hesitant because we also knew that it was such a large amount that we had lost. But I think that it was pretty telling, right? That the community, they just wanted to be a part of it and they wanted to give back and they wanted to, help out. And so that was just really cool. 291 had, Matt Hondorf with Colorado Spirits Collective had reached out kind of in conjunction with his whiskey church and just so happened to be at 291. So there was a single barrel that was auctioned off.
We were there when it happened. Yeah, it was pretty incredible to witness.
Talnua, they kind of did something similar where they launched their Acorn philanthropic arm of Talnua, where they want to give back to different organizations that they think are doing good work and just are playing an important part of not only the industry, I guess, but just in general. And so we were the recipient of that.
They raised
they donated a portion of every bottle sale to our Hail fundraiser. And then we did a t-shirt online fundraiser for folks that, who were not local that couldn't take part in some of those things and who still wanted to help out. So, overall that was a $10,000 fundraising initiative that we were not expecting at all.
Right.
Which was really
and that you use that $10,000 to go get more seed, right? So that you could grow more crop, right? And that
So
and you
we
guys
sourced
some barley for that from that, right?
We did. We actually we were up there last week. And probably the next couple of weeks we'll still be kind of toting barley back from Wyoming. There's a farmer that we knew who was growing Odyssey barley variety, which we had grown previously and a lot of our breweries and
distilleries
had loved. And so we were kind of, it was kind of great that we could actually bring that variety back and be able to purchase that, with the help of the community with that $10,000 raised. So that was really cool.
Yeah. So most of that grain will just go directly into malting. Just a little bit on the Odyssey variety, since we were talking about it, it's a non-GN. So it's non-glycosidic nitrile. So that's something that distillers are kind of asking for these days, because that interaction of that compound with copper can be a carcinogen eventually. Like, so they're really aware of it in Scotland, right? And
interesting.
And Ireland, I suppose, as well. And so that's just something that's come up recently. And there's a lot of barley varieties that are being developed with this non-GN trait just for distillers. So
interesting.
And Genie is a low GN as well. So like any of our barley that's being used for like whiskey production, there's no chance of that interaction occurring. But
I had no idea.
That's wild. There's not very many people that know about it, but
I mean, I imagine that's probably a future regulatory thing to be aware of, right?
So, exactly.
And if you guys see it, to jump on it now and get yourself established, that's probably better for you.
Especially single malt production as well, right?
Like, for sure.
In bourbon, like, it's not, the malt bill isn't that big of a portion of the grain that's actually being used. It's mostly corn, but you don't have that challenge, right?
Yeah.
So,
So tell us, shifting gears a little bit, you guys are not only the recipients of stuff like that, which is great, and you know, unique story to tell there, right? Which is great. We're glad there's at least an effort to go back local farming. But you guys also give back too, right? And you mentioned the Veterans Project, where you guys donated all the malt for a particular project there. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, we donated 100% of the grain to, it was a collaboration between Bent Barley Brewing Company, Launchpad Brewing, and they brewed it all at Dry Dock Brewing Company. And so 100% of the proceeds from that beer that will be on tap at all three of those locations is going to a veterans organization that's based down in Aurora down there. So,
And that's an ongoing project, right? You guys haven't seen the end of that one yet?
Right. Mm-hmm. Yep. Okay. Oh, yep. Cool. Beer's still on tap. So, you know, that'll probably be a couple more months. I would imagine that, you know, they'll have that beer on tap, but, yeah, I think that we like to take part in a lot of those different projects that, you know, folks will ask us often, you know, if we want to donate malt for different fundraising events. And I think it's just really cool to be a part of those things. So
right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Yeah, whenever we get a chance to kind of be involved in some of those projects, we're typically don't say no, I guess. So
yeah.
I mean, whenever there's a good cause, we're definitely
interested
in helping.
On the whiskey side of things too, there was an agriculture conference that came into town, and they wanted to create they had called it a regeneratively grown cocktail, I guess. And so they knew that we were, you know, using kind of our regenerative practices here on the farm, and so it was kind of close to that, I guess. But anyway, we had donated some whiskey to that conference too. So so it's just nice to get your product out there, but then also know that you're helping out for good guys.
Yeah.
Well,
let's get rid of this cat. I'm put it in the crate.
Oh man. If it's not a fly, it's a cat now, I guess.
Yeah. cat.
This other one's just chilling over here in the bag.
Yeah.
For those of you guys can't see, there's our gear stuff is over here, and the cats have previously been parked on our gear and kind of napping. And
hey.
Uh-oh. Oh, yep.
Oh, here comes backup, Todd.
Yeah, watch your back.
I don't want to go on the crate. Are you alive?
Yeah, I'm just fine. Sounded worse than it was.
That's why you wear the flannel.
Yeah, it's like,
nothing will touch that flannel.
Like, I'm not going in back in there. Oh well. All right.
That was funny. Well, thank you guys for sharing your story, and we look forward to your tasting next. But obviously, guys, check out Root Shoot anytime you have an opportunity to pick a bottle. Which, by the way, where can they buy your?
So you can find our whiskey on shelves. Basically, if you go to our website at rootshootspirits.com, we have kind of a whiskey finder map that it lists all the retailers and all the restaurants that are pouring it to. But from Colorado Springs to Fort Collins and Denver, and even over to
Breckenridge, I think there's some.
I think Breckenridge too. So yeah. So.
Colorado. So obviously, look them up. Right, find your local retailer, and if you're at a place where they serve a tap, right, ask for their products, right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Support local farming too. Ask where those beers are sourced and their grains are sourced. That's a key component to their project here. So. Be sure to look that up. And thanks guys for coming on.
Thank you.
So much fun. We appreciate you guys.
Thanks for having us. It was fun.
Yeah, great.
Cool. So we're here with Root Shoot, and we're going to taste their batch 2 of their whiskey. So Emily, why don't you guide us on what we're drinking here?
Sure. So it's a 4 year and 4 months old American single malt whiskey, aged in new American oak barrels and distilled in at vapor, of course. But on the nose, you get a little bit of a honeyed granola, maybe even some cobbler.
It's like a
little bit of that dark cinnamon. Fruit, like the black cherry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can definitely smell the black cherry in there as well.
Yep.
Yeah. Even some dried fruit in there.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah.
Like I said, it's a little bit different than our batch 1 that we released last year. In the way that we have a little bit more of the darker specialty malts in this batch too. So I think that's where some of those aromas and flavors are kind of pulling from.
Yeah. Well, and you guys have a special tag on there, right? I would usually not accompany a batch 2, but bottled and bond, right? I mean, that's kind of cool.
Yeah.
Right.
That's kind of what we wanted all of our whiskeys to be, is to hit that mark where we could say that it was at least aged 4 years. So
I'm gonna take a taste here.
Yeah.
You want to take it away with the flavor?
I'm getting a lot of those toasted malt, heavy darker notes stuff in there a lot. That comes through, and that the baking spices come through, and then you got the little heat and cinnamon stuff on the finish there. Very pleasant. The heat's not off putting at all.
I'm always terrible at tasting notes anyway, so I just know that it tastes great.
Yeah. I either like it or I don't. I like it.
Obviously, we're getting all those dark, rich notes on there, but what's the mash bill that goes into this?
So it's 7% special roast, which is like very like cocoa flavors, like really kind of like dark chocolate, like baking chocolate almost. Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of that's
coming through. Yeah. Cara Ruby, which has like a little bit of like strawberry almost kind of coming on the finished malt, like some beers that are made with that. Like there's like a weird, well, not weird, I guess, but there's just like a little bit of a like strawberry undertone. Distiller's malt. So that's the majority of it. That's like 52% of it. Pilsner malt, which is 20% of it. So, and then Hella Dark. So Hella Dark is,
I like the name of that. That's awesome.
It ended up a lot darker than we expected it to be.
It was hella dark.
It was hella dark.
Yeah. And that's sounds like aptly named.
Almost like some raisin that's coming through.
Okay.
That might be where that's
coming
from.
Playing into that cherry, like that dark stone fruit. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, it's hella good, so.
Yeah.
I mean, by the way, I forgot that nose note that I was picking up, it's like almost like a candied date. It smells I love dates. So
that's probably coming from the Hella Dark, honestly. So
yeah.
Well, I tell you what, this is definitely a cold weather whiskey. It's it's warm, it's bold, would go well on a cold winter night, right? warm you up and
right next to a fireplace.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. And we get plenty of those right here.
It's warm coming next week. So
yeah. Next week. Felt like it was already here last week, bro.
Yeah.
Cold nights.
And then like the very end of this was Genie Pale on the on the malt bill. So like what is that? 1, 2, 3, 4, 6 different types of malt. So
wow.
Pretty interesting. Mm-hmm. And the way we came up with that was basically doing the hot steep method, which is basically making a tea of malts. So you're just making sugar water and we kind of mix those together and kind of tasted through them and poured different amounts into it. And we're like, oh, that tastes pretty good. Awesome. Yeah. Let's go with that.
Right.
So that's how we're coming up with our mash bills is doing the hot steep method.
Okay. So doing that hot steep, are some of those flavors, are they coming through?
Well, we got to remember 4 years ago. So I'm sure
It was a good decision.
Yeah.
the proof is in the bottle. Like, yeah, it's good. Whatever it was good. Oh, this is good, guys. Yeah. Congratulations on this batch too. And
Thank you.
So folks can look this up coming here in the next couple of weeks. Which
yeah.
By the time we probably release this episode,
it'll be everywhere.
It'll be everywhere. Yeah. So and hopefully there'll still be some supply, right? So
yeah,
for sure.
Yeah. And so tell us again, how can people find your whiskey on the shelf?
So you can find it. Easiest way is to go to rootshootspirits.com. And we've got a map that is basically our whiskey finder. So you can see all of the retail locations and the restaurants that stock it.
So. Are there any places that ship out of state?
No, we are only in Colorado.
Okay.
Stay tuned.
All right. Well, so you've out of staters, email us.
Yeah, maybe, maybe by the time this episode's out.
We're going to age in a barrel for 4 years. This episode's going to be bottled and bond.
Yeah. That's putting the pressure on me.
That's good. No pressure at all.
Yeah.
All
right.
Well, yeah. Thanks, guys. This
is very delightful.
And cheers, Root Shoot.
Yeah.
Thank you for joining us on Whiskey Wanderlust. Subscribe to the show on YouTube, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and all other major podcast platforms. And be sure to leave us a rating and review. Follow us on social media and visit us online at whiskeywanderlust.co.